Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In 2002, Malawi was in the grips of famine. The small, landlocked African country had experienced 2 years of drought. One 14-year-old boy dreamed of bringing electricity and water to his village. His neighbors called him Misala, crazy. William Kamkwamba is with me in the studio to describe how he taught himself to build a windmill and created currents of energy and hope. Also here in the studio, Brian Mueller. He's co-author of a new book titled The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. Brian, talk about how you and William first met.
Sure. I'd been a reporter in Africa, covering Central Africa, mostly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for about 5 years, working for the Associated Press and also for Harper's Magazine, and covering that pretty horrific conflict that's killed about 5 million people in 10 years. And so a large part of my job for those years was kind of chronicling the dead of Congo. And the stories that came out of Congo are pretty similar to the stories that, you know, we see coming out of a lot of parts of Africa. And I had written a book called All Things Must Fight to Live, and was actually turning it in, and was feeling pretty disillusioned about that place and not knowing if I ever wanted to really go back. And I see this front page story in the Wall Street Journal about this boy in Malawi who builds windmills out of garbage and creates electricity. And I was like, my God, you know, this is a story that I've been looking to tell this whole time. And fortune had it that William was coming through New York on his way to see some windmills in California, is after he'd been discovered. And we really hit it off, and I've spent the last year together really working on this really incredible book.
Brian Mueller, he's co-author with William Kamkwamba of the new book. It's titled The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. William, it's good to have you here.
Oh, it's nice to be here as well.
Good. Tell us about your life before age 14, when you were still in school.
When I was still at school, life was normal. My parents are farmers, and every time when I woke up in the morning, I would help my parents doing some farming, going to a field. We grew maize and a little bit of tobacco. So the life was like that, and also doing like what other kids elsewhere do, playing around. And I was also different games. I was also interested on learning how things work. So this is how I almost spent my time when I was still in school.
But you must have been disappointed when your family told you they could no longer pay the $80-some dollars a year for your school tuition.
Yeah, when I found out that my parents would no longer would not manage to send me back to school, I was very worried, because I noticed that I automatically become a farmer. It's not that I hate becoming a farmer, but becoming a farmer, which growing crops to live, not growing crops to benefit. They're living like in the situation where you'll be determined by the land or the price of the seeds. So when I was looking at my father, thinking that way, I was really worried that if I'm not going to progress with my school, then I'll be automatically become like him.
Like your father. And at the time, Malawi was undergoing this enormous drought. What was it that got you thinking about the idea of a windmill?
The idea of the windmill came after I dropped out of school. I started going to the library. It was just a small place which was funded by the U.S. government. So I was hoping that through reading books, I will keep up with my friends who are going to school by that time. I was interested in reading science books, especially physics, and then I read some electromagnetics and then become obsessed with the how electromagnetics work. And I continued doing that, and then one day when I went to the library, I found the book with the cover of the book had a picture of the windmill, and then inside they say that windmill could pump water and generate electricity. And then I said to myself, pump water meant irrigation, a defense against hunger. I say, if I can build one of these machines, then all this problem we are experiencing, the famine problem, it will be solved by this machine. We'll be able to grow crops 3 times a year or 2 times a year.
So in effect, what you did was to teach yourself physics.
Yes.
That's pretty special, Brian.
Yeah, no, and it's a little more complicated than that. William couldn't read English very well, and so these books, this first book was called Explaining Physics, and it was a British physics book, and the text is pretty complicated, and so what he did, he would just study these diagrams and pictures, and if it said figure 10, he would go into the text and he would find where it says figure 10 and learn those English words around that, and basically was able to teach himself basic physics in that way. And but I think it seemed to me that he already had these things in his mind and these pictures that just kind of snapped into place for him. And it's pretty incredible.
So then, after studying these books carefully, after going back and back and back to the library to learn as much as you could, what made you think you could build a windmill?
What made me to think that I could build a windmill was the pictures. I say to myself, if this picture is in this book, it means that somewhere else somebody managed to do the same thing. So I say, I think I can also do the same thing. If this thing was done by a human being, I'm also a human being. I think if I can try this thing, I'm pretty sure that I can do it.
But you had to have materials. You had to have money to buy materials.
Yeah, by that time I didn't have money to buy materials.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what did you do?
So I went to a junkyard. My former secondary school used to be a garage for a certain tobacco estate. So when the tobacco estate stopped operating from that place, they turned that place, they gave that place to the Minister of Education. And the Minister of Education turned that place to a school. And then I was going there for school. And then when it comes to look for the materials, I just remembered that my school, there's a junkyard at my school.
Junk.
Yeah.
All junk.
Yeah.
So tell me what kind of materials you withdrew from that junkyard.
At the junkyard, I found the tractor fan, which I used as a lot of my windmill. I also found the...
I don't understand the word you used.
Rotor.
Yeah, rotor. Yeah. Okay.
Basically a rusted tractor fan. That,
a tractor fan. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Go ahead.
And also a shock absorber, which I used as a shaft of the windmill. Yeah, there was I also found some bearings for the windmill at the junkyard.
bearings for the windmill.
Yeah.
This is an incredible story.
Yeah, over a matter of several months, he would go back there day by day. Yeah, and he would just, because it kind of replaced school in his mind, because his imagination could work, and he would see these pieces like the shock absorber, and he would imagine how it would work. And so his imagination was constantly moving and trying to picture this machine in his brain.
Were you going back and forth again to the library to sort of check out how this was done?
Yeah, I was going back and forth to the library, but mostly I was just like going back to check in the same book to see the pictures, how exactly this machine looked like. And then that picture was just like to keep me going off with my project. When I'm seeing the picture, say like to myself that I need to build one of this machine.
So you had this in your mind, you kept going back to the library. You kept following piece by piece. I have to find something that would work here. I have to find something that would work there. And then you'd go to the junkyard and find it.
Yeah. Normally at the junkyard, when I'm going to a junkyard, I was going there without knowing exactly what I'm looking for.
I see.
But I was just picking up pieces of metals, and then I'll examining them and say that I think this thing can work at particular angle. So, yeah.
William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind. That's the title of the new book. We'll take a short break, then your calls. Welcome back. We're talking with William Kamkwamba and Brian Mueller. Together, they have co-authored the book, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It's all about a young man living in Malawi, which was famine-stricken, drought-stricken, who had to drop out of school because his parents did not have the $80 a year to send him, but his interest in science and physics kept him going back and back and back to a small library established by the U.S. there in Malawi, to a point where he began looking at studying a picture of a windmill, and finally created it himself. I want to know, William, how you created circuit breakers.
I created the circuit breakers using a radio magnet, a radio stereo speaker magnet, and some nails. I did that after I saw how the electric bell works. So what I did, I put the two nails. I wound the coil on two both my nails, and then there was a magnet in between. So the way it was working, it was that when the current is passing by, it was able to balance the magnet in between. But if there's like a surge, there's like a short current, and then it could have the one side of the magnet turn into the one coil turn into a magnet, a strong magnet. Also the other side, and then the other side it will be pushing the magnet in between, and the other one will be pulling it. When it is pulling, there was a switch in between, and then it will switch off the current, not pass by.
So you know, just picked up nails, picked up wire, made it, and used the magnet from the radio that you had a radio in your house. I found that interesting.
Yeah, I had a radio. And also the radio which I used to take the magnet to wind was because before I built the windmill, I used to fix radios. Me and my cousin, we learned how to fix radios when I was around 10.
Oh, I see. Yeah. There's also a story in the book as to how you used your flip-flops to engage in this whole process.
Yeah, I used my flip-flops to build the switches for the electricity. After I managed to make the window, I noticed that in order to use my electricity properly, I also need to have switches as the other electricity have. And then I decided to build it using the flip-flops and also PVC pipes for the board of the switch.
Yeah, so basically he took a PVC pipe and melted it over a fire and made a switch box. And then using bicycle spokes and the rubber from his flip-flops, he made the switches themselves. So the toggles, the switches themselves are from the rubber of the flip-flops. And so this was after he had managed to, his cousin had found a car battery on the side of the road and given it to him. And so he charged the car battery from his windmill and was able to power these four bulbs. And so he had it on this really intricate system of switches and circuit breakers.
And so, what did the people in your village think of what you were doing? And what did your family think?
When I started my project, the people in my community, my village, they were laughing at me. They thought that I'm going crazy because it wasn't normal. It is not normal for somebody normal going to a junkyard collecting pieces of metal and saying that I'm trying to build a windmill, and the people, they don't know what windmill is, and then they were thinking that maybe I'm smoking marijuana. So it was challenging for me.
How long did it take you to build the windmill?
It took me about 3 months looking for materials and then putting them together.
And how big was the windmill?
My first windmill was 5 meters high.
5 meters.
That's 16 feet high, yeah.
16
yeah.
feet high.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
grief. That's pretty big.
Yeah, it was on a tower made of blue gum branches. And when he's saying, you know, this 3 months of collecting materials, he had no tools as well. And so for hammers, he just used random pieces of metal and banged them. And when he repaired radios with his cousin, his soldering iron was a nail heated over a fire to get it red hot. And that's also what he used for his drill. And so I've seen him make another windmill using these kind of rudimentary tools. And it takes forever to heat a nail over a fire and bore it through, plastic. Blades and wood, even. He would actually put it through the wooden post. And what were you saying, William? As soon as the nail heated, it would cool down or something, right?
Yeah. The challenging when I was using my tools hitting the nails, you know, that I'll be building the fire somewhere, and then when I'm hitting it, and then to take that nail to a place where I want to drill a hole. When I'm getting to a place, it has get cold, and then it is.
You got to go back.
So I have like to learn.
All right. So tell me what happened when you first turned that windmill on.
when I first turned on the windmill and then the light came on, I was very happy because I've been working for that project for so long, and people have been saying that you are crazy. So I thought that if that thing didn't work that time, then the people could have really proved me that they were right, that I'm going crazy. And then it was a moment when I was very happy to see it working. I say like, I couldn't stop looking at it because it was like telling people that what I've been working on, it wasn't just craziness, but it was something that we can be using.
All right, so it turned the light bulb on. What else did it do?
The other thing which it did is to power a radio.
Power on a radio.
In the moment that he actually, when he was started to raise his tower, build the tower, people from all around, they could see him, and so
sure.
They started gathering around.
Yeah.
And so these same people, these doubters and the people who had mocked him for months, were down below, and it was really this scene, this really dramatic scene where he climbed up and, you know, unleashed the blades of the windmill, and they started spinning and connected the bulb, and it just started glowing in his hand, and everybody started screaming, you know, down below, and it was this kind of this vindication for him, and I can't imagine what it must have felt like. So.
Brian, talk about what was going on in Malawi at the time.
Right around that time, as we said, in 2000, there was a really horrible drought. Usually, you know, droughts aren't that uncommon in that part of the country, but because everybody's sustenance farmers, people just grow to live, as he said. And so you only have you grow to fill your storage room up, and then... So that year, people only got maybe two or three bags of maize, and that was the case for William's family. Normally, they would get about maybe 20 or something, or 14. And so everybody started running out of maize very quickly. And normally, the government has a surplus of grain that they would come and bring in and release it on the market and help people kind of get a leg up until the next harvest. But there were some programs in place at that time with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to help Malawi pay off its debt. And so one of the suggestions made by these Bretton Woods organizations is that, well, why don't you sell off some of this surplus grain because it's too expensive to keep? And what happened was some corrupt people in the government sold off all of it. And so when the drought came, there was nothing left. And very quickly, people started dying. And it was also during the rainy season. And so when their bodies were so susceptible, cholera usually comes in the rainy season in Africa quite regularly. But people were so susceptible, or weak and kind of feeble at that moment, they were more susceptible to it, and it just ravaged people. So about 10,000 people died in Malawi. At the time, William's family was forced to cut down to about one meal per day.
Ah.
And he has six sisters. And so it was pretty horrific on his family. I mean, he can probably describe what happened, you know, to their bodies, actually. I mean, it was...
Because we are forced to eat one meal a day at night, and then everyone started losing weight because we weren't eating enough food. And then I look at my father, even me, myself, and then it was really a difficult time.
His father is a bulking, huge man. He's a muscular, very big guy. And... began losing so much weight, he began to obsess about it. And each morning he would wake up, and he would hang himself on his tobacco scale to weigh himself, and he was sort of watching himself slowly starve to death. And we later found out that he was skipping meals in order to feed his children, and at one point he actually lost his vision because of this. And so it was really, really difficult. And his mother, during this time, actually gave birth to his little sister.
Ah.
And she talked to me about nursing this child during the grips of this famine, and every night, and her hands would shake because she was not getting enough food. And so it just makes this story to me just so much more important. And I mean, just this guy, I mean, most people wouldn't have done this during this famine, and he sort of persevered and had this forward vision that you know, looking for food with his father wasn't going to help. People were saying, you're crazy, why don't you go out and help your dad look for food, you know, you silly boy. But he was like, no, I'm going to make a windmill, and I'm going to solve all the problems, you know, not just to go out looking for food, but we're going to...
Did that little baby girl survive?
Yeah, she's 8 years now.
She's 8 years old.
So, yeah. William, tell her what the baby's name is.
The baby's name is Tiamike, which means let's thank. Because even it was a she born in a hard time, and then she was born with 5 pounds, and then it was like blessed. No one couldn't believe that during that time a baby could have born such weight. Yeah.
Her name means thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, of course. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have a number of callers. Let's hear what they have to say. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Joseph in Seattle, Washington. Good morning. You're on the air, Joseph.
Good morning. I'm very impressed with the story because I think, as we say, we reap what we sow. Dr. Banda, whom I knew as a child, because after he left Britain as a medical doctor, he came to practice in Ghana, as a friend of my brother who led Ghana to independence with Nkrumah. But then when he went back to Malawi, he insisted that Latin should be taught in all schools. And impressively, the children from those schools went to Europe to compete with European kids and won numerous awards. It tells you the importance of reading and the importance of libraries to communities. And so all the years that I've lived in Seattle, very often I spent most of my private time going to schools. A lot of kids I meet on the street and with their mothers, and I always ask them, what book are you reading?
Ah, that's lovely, Joseph. Thank you for calling. Are you still a diligent reader, William?
Right now I'm still in school, so I'm reading different books in terms of school books, academic books. Or for my free time, I'm reading the Franklin Benjamin book.
Benjamin Franklin's book. Yeah. You are now at the African Leadership Academy in Johannesburg.
Yes.
And how did you get there?
When I went to attend the TED conference in Arusha, Tanzania.
TED conference. Tell us about the TED conference.
What happened was after William's windmill, you know, it was 4 years after he'd made the windmill, and the people who ran the library, it was called Malawi Teacher Training Activity. They're a group funded by USAID here in the United States. The director heard about William's windmill and said, you know, this kid got this information from our library, and he was, of course, beaming with pride, and went out to see it. He was so impressed. He was a Malawian guy, this guy named Dr. Chazime, and he brought in a local journalist from, he's like, we have to shout this from the rooftops. This kid, this is what people need to see coming out of Africa. And so he brought the local journalist who did a big story on William in the local newspaper, and that caught the attention of some bloggers in the capital, Lilongwe. And that caught the attention of something called the TED Conference here in the United States. TED Conference is kind of a Davos of innovative thinkers and brilliant minds and inventors and people like William. And so they hold annual conferences each year, and they decided to do their first conference in Africa that year, and it was in Arusha, Tanzania. And they discovered William and invited him to give a speech on stage. And it was the very first time William, I mean, they actually came out to his village and found him. They, through Dr. Chazime, they sat down, you know, under a mango tree and filled out his application. It was the first time he'd ever been on an airplane, the first time he had ever slept in a hotel as he waited to get on his flight.
On a mattress.
On a mattress, yes. And when he got to TED, I think for the first time, William, you were surrounded by colleagues. I mean, I think you felt like you were one of a part of something. And it was also that at that point he had never seen the internet before. And someone said, you know, William, have you ever seen Google? And he said, what? And they said, what do you want to search for? You can search for anything. And he said, obviously, windmills. And how many hits came up after your first?
It was about 10 million, 10 million results. And I was like, wow, if I had this type of thing, it for my way would have been easier because I would have been seeing some pictures, yeah.
All right, short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Pew Health Group, part of the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the health and safety of all Americans at pewtrusts.org. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Ever since writing the bestseller Taliban, which was published shortly before 9/11, the Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid has been considered an authority on Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's based in Lahore. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about the tough choices President Obama is facing in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with two wonderful people in the studio. William Kamkwamba, a young man who, through his own diligence and scientific creativity, and with simply pictures to go by, built a windmill for his community, which in Malawi at the time was undergoing great drought and great famine. His villagers thought he was crazy going back to the junkyard, but build that windmill he did. Brian Mueller is also here. He's a reporter, a writer. He has helped in telling this story by writing the book, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. We'll go back to the phones now to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Eddie. You're on the air.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank you.
William Mulibwanji.
Tribunal Mbanj.
Tribunal, we wanted to let you know that we've been following your story for years. I'm a fellow Malawian. And Mr. Miller, thank you for taking your story out to the out of Malawi. One of our old leaders had once said, Kamuzu, that he always wondered how many Albert Einsteins perished under a mango tree. And it seems that you did not perish under the mango tree for lack of resources.
Thank heavens.
And you have been an inspiration to all Malawians. As I'm speaking now, there are a lot of Malawians in the D.C. area listening to you. So you should know there are a lot of people who are proud of you, and we are very, very proud of you. And hopefully you will take it even further. I don't know how we can be able to meet you in the area if you're still in the area here, but it would be great if we are able to see you.
You can go on William's website, and there's going to be some updates. We're going to coming back through D.C., so we may do some public events. But check his website. It's www.williamkamkwamba.com.
And that's spelled K-A-M-K-W-A-M-B, like boy, A. It's also attached to our website at drshow.org. William, how did those comments make you feel?
I feel happy when people are commenting on what I did. Yeah.
You must be filled with a kind of joy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm happy.
I'm glad you're happy. Thanks for calling. And let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Linda.
Yes, good morning. I'm aware that this was a phenomenal achievement, but he's not the only intelligent young man in Africa, and he was able to do this because of the library. And I'm wondering how the library had gotten its books and if there was anything we could do to assist in this. I was just at a school where they were accessing classrooms full of books and put them in the dumpster.
Hmm.
So this is my comment. Is there anything
sure
we can do to provide people with the kind of inspiration that he so well was able to use?
Linda, thank you so much for that generous thought. Brian?
I believe the windmills came through to the Malawi teacher training activity through a group called International Book Bank. And you can go online and look through them. And there's several ways to do this. Go on their website and probably you can.
All right. Thanks for calling. Now to Ramey in Huntsville, Alabama. You're on the air.
Good morning, William, Brian, and Di. Actually, the author just addressed or commented on my questions earlier on the role of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the government in this role. So I'll just quickly say thank you, Brian and Di and the Wall Street Journal for bringing this story to light, and best wishes to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Here's an email that reminds us all. This sent by Allison, who says, I keep thinking about that book with the windmill on the cover. Someone donated that old book that eventually ended up in that tiny Malawi library. This should remind us all that books can be precious as gold. No one should ever throw away a book. There are so many other young Williams and Wilmas out there waiting for their own spark of inspiration that can come from a single book.
I'd like to also say it's not just schools in Malawi that need books. Schools in this own our own country need books.
Absolutely.
And so if you have any books, I'm sure any number of public schools would love to take them off your hands.
All right. To Susan in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. I just was struck by a sort of reverse similarity between William and the biblical Noah. Noah building an ark for a flood that everyone laughed at him about. And thankfully for William, it didn't take him 125 years to build the windmill. I was actually amazed that it only took 3 months. I can't comprehend what he did. It was phenomenal. But so in that, with him building a windmill in order to bring water to an area instead of building a boat to get out of the water, I'm wondering if he has a faith that helped him during any of this time where it seemed like everyone thought he was crazy and, you know, I mean, just the daily trek to a junkyard and a back and forth to a library. Did he think? I heard his comments that he knew he could do this because he could see the pictures and a human had done that, so he knew he could do it. But did it take any more than that? Does he have something outside of himself that he reached to a faith? Maybe.
Mostly it was the picture, and also I trust myself that he. I had a confidence on my own, saying that if somewhere else this thing is existing, and then I think I can also do it. Mostly it was within myself saying that I can do it.
But she was also asking, his family is very Presbyterian, and very devout Presbyterian. Asking your faith, what your faith was. So, and I love her question, because after William managed to build this windmill, his mother indeed started calling him Noah. As kind of a joke, but how Noah delivered his people from the flood, William delivered us from kind of darkness and hunger.
Well, that's what I want to understand. What happened next after that initial windmill went up?
I guess, William, describe what happened after the TED conference, and when people, he had some very generous donors come up and offer to help send him back to school and help with some donations to improve his village. And so, William, why don't you talk about that? I mean, what?
Yeah, after TED, people are starting donating, and then I was able to draw a borehole, which we put the solar pump, and then we pumped the water, and then put two big tanks, and then we pumped the water from the ground into the tanks, and then starting irrigation for the second crops, so that now we can grow crops 3 or 2 times a year.
So basically, he pumped water. I mean, normally to get a borehole that deep, it takes a lot of machinery, and you have to rent all this stuff. And we're not talking a fortune here. It didn't cost that much to drill a borehole. And it was just.
But how deep did it go?
How deep is the borehole?
65 meters.
65 meters over, but and.
About 100 feet.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And he was able to, you know, pump this water and store it in these tanks. And they installed about 6 water faucets all around his community, and so it's the only running water, clean running water, in about 60 miles. Before that, his mother had to either go down to a local, like a marsh, and collect water that they drank. Some years later, another pump was made drilled by the government, but it took his mother about 2 or 3 hours a day
just to get water.
Just to get clean water. And so you can imagine the amount of time it saved her, plus all these other women who can just go and turn on a running faucet.
And how far away from the house was this faucet?
The faucet now, she just turns around from her. It's right by the chicken coop, and she just turns it on. Before, it was about what, a mile away.
Yeah,
a mile and a half. Yeah. But you have to wait in line. And,
oh, sure.
And then so she had the buckets are heavy. So William and his father were out in the field. So his mother and his sisters would go out and they'd collect this water and, you know, lugging these buckets of water on their heads.
So William, how do you see your future? What do you want to do?
First, I want to finish my education.
Of course.
Yeah. So when I finish my education, and then I'll go back to my community, and then start working on renewable energy. And also, there's also other things which I'm working on right now. I'm planning to do.
Tell about your drill, your water pump that you want to make.
Yeah, right now I'm planning to design the water pump, water well drilling machine, which will be like a vice. It will be maybe kids can be driving it and then drilling the borehole, because I noticed that water is there underground, but it just need the way to get them from underground.
Of course.
Yeah, so that people can have a clean water.
Suppose, though, William, someone came to you and said, William Kumkwamba, you clearly are a genius. We want you to work here in the United States. We will pay you a lot of money if you will develop your ideas here for us, your plans for renewable energy, your whatever you want to do, we'll let you do it and we'll pay you a lot of money. Would you stay here?
No, I cannot stay here because I noticed that there's a lot of things which need to be done back home than here. So if I can stay here, everyone can be like coming to stay here. It means that there is no one who is going to be developing our place. And also to myself, sometimes I say that if our parents here in the United States, long time ago, the ones they started developing this country left to some other place, this place couldn't be like the way it is right now. So also for us in Africa, if we'll be moving from our countries going somewhere else, which means it will remain the same way it is forever.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What about your sisters? What are they doing?
My oldest sister, she's married, and the rest, I sent them to school. They are schooling.
They're all in school.
Yeah, William sent them all back to school. He's paying the school fees for his sisters.
How are you paying the school fees?
Through the money that we've gotten from the book so far and through some donations. William has a foundation called the Moving Windmills Project that he started, and it works to send his cousins and his family and all the neighbors back to school. And they're also working to rebuild the primary school in his village because, you know, it has holes in the roof. It's overcrowded. The kids, and they're learning under trees and the rain. I mean, and they don't have no books or no desks. And so through this foundation, he's trying to rebuild these because the government doesn't build schools in Malawi. It was all done by the church. And so they pay teachers, but nothing else really. And so he's going to go through and try to help these kids, you know, have a new, brand new school with good roofs. And he's also started a soccer club in his village for kids who have dropped out of school like him so they don't go off and drink. And so,
Brian, how has your own internal life been changed by your relationship with this truly dedicated young man?
I spent so many, so much time and so many stories and so many words.
Sad stories.
Writing sad stories. I wrote so many of them and I wrote a book full of them. And, you know, and I didn't want to leave Africa with just a bunch of blood-soaked pages. I mean, that was kind of my wish. And so to meet this guy has really kind of made me remember why I fell in love with Africa in the first place, the resourcefulness of these people, the warmness of these people. And what's also done is taught me that if there's one guy in Malawi, like William Kumkwamba, there's hundreds of guys in Africa who are like him. And we need to find these people and we need to just give them small, small slivers of opportunity to lift them up. And, you know, we talk about just sending money to Africa and aid to Africa. But this is the way I think you save Africa, is you let these people like William Kumkwamba save themselves.
How many are there like you that you know, William?
I think there are a lot of people out there. But Brian has already said that we just need to find them and trying to find the way how to lift them. I see like many people can do what I did. Right now, I'm trying like to share my knowledge with some other young people in my community by teaching them how I did it. And then I still believe that there's a lot of talented young people.
So you will go back to your home. You will take on new renewable energy projects. What? Like, in addition to wind, solar, what else?
Right now I'm planning to start working with wind first, and then I'll be starting with the wind, and also the machine which I'm saying that I'm planning to design to drill borehole, and then I'll be putting these two things. It will be working together, drilling the well, and then putting the pump and using the windmills to pump water.
Well, William, I speak, I know, for the millions of people out there who are listening this morning, to say to you, congratulations. You have done a marvelous job.
Thank you.
And thank you. And thank you, Brian, for bringing this story out. It's called The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. I'll be off for the next few days for a voice treatment. Hope to be back with you early next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.